and political analyst Saad Shaath speaking to us from Belfast. Also, a special thanks to you for staying with us on Stabate. Goodbye, everybody.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Chapter Ali Imran from the Holy Quran, verses number 29 and 30, recited by Saeed Maliki.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Qul in ما في صدوركم أو تبدوه يعلمه الله ويعلم ما في السماوات وما في الأرض والله على كل شيء قدير يوم تجد كل نفس ما عملت من خير محضرا وما عملت من سوء تود لو أن بينها وبينه أمدا بعيدا ويحذركم الله نفسه والله رؤوف بالعباد
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, whether you hide what is in your heart or manifest it, Allah knows it, and He knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth, and Allah hath power over all things. On the day that every soul shall find present what it has done of good and what it has done of evil, it shall wish that between it and that evil there were a long duration of time, and Allah makes you to be cautious of retribution from Himself, and Allah is compassionate to the servants.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
This hour's top stories: international condemnations pour in following the assassination of a top Iranian nuclear scientist on Friday. The highest court in the U.S. state of Pennsylvania deals yet another blow to President Trump's attempts to overturn the presidential election results. And UK police clash with protesters rallying against coronavirus restrictions in London, making scores of arrests. Welcome to the program. International condemnations keep pouring in over the assassination of top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Latest reaction came from U.S. Senator Bernie Sanders, who slammed the targeted killing as, quote, reckless, provocative, and illegal. The Democratic politician warned that the deadly attack was clearly intended to undermine U.S.-Iran diplomacy. A spokesman for the U.N. Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned what he called extrajudicial killing. Also, the UN Special Rapporteur on Extrajudicial Execution said Fakhrizadeh's assassination is a violation of international human rights law. The European Union blasted as a criminal act the assassination, saying it runs counter to the principle of respect for human rights. The Turkish Foreign Ministry also called for the perpetrators to be held accountable for the heinous crime. The assassination of the top Iranian nuclear scientist has drawn condemnation from Iranians of all walks of life. In Tehran, a rally was held to slam the terrorist attack. On that story, we have Youssef Jalali reporting.
2:30 p.m. local time on Friday, in a countryside area east of Tehran, a truck loaded with explosives blew up to intercept car carrying top Iranian nuclear scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. Eyewitnesses say five or six gunmen then rushed from a nearby vehicle and opened fire on his car. Fakhrizadeh was seriously injured and taken to hospital, but medics were unable to save his life. The incident immediately sent its shockwaves across Iran and beyond, with Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif calling the attack an act of terror and linking it to Israel. Inside Iran, the assassination comes as a shock. Less than 24 hours after the incident, people from all walks of life gathered here outside the Iranian parliament to condemn the assassination, which they view as grave as the U.S.'s assassination of top IRGC commander Qasem Soleimani in January.
What happened to our nuclear scientist was carried out by the same terrorists who killed Qasem Soleimani. Like Mr. Soleimani, Fakhrizadeh offered many services to our nation.
If we back down on this terrorist act, the U.S. and Israel will become more insolent towards us. We have gathered here to urge the government and lawmakers to take a tough stance towards the perpetrators to avoid further such incidents.
Fakhrizadeh served as the head of the Research and Innovation Organization of the Defense Ministry. Iranian officials say he had a long history in defense innovations and had made key efforts to promote Iran's nuclear energy program.
Remember that name, Fakhrizadeh.
This had made him the number one target of Israel's intelligence services, which have a track record of targeted killings of Iranian nuclear scientists nearly a decade ago.
Israel is not willing to see Iran's advancement in science and technology. It killed four other Iranian nuclear scientists, and now it assassinated Mr. Fakhrizadeh. But Israel should know that it cannot stop Iran's peaceful nuclear program, because those martyrs have trained numerous young scientists who will take the lead in this field.
Observers say the assassination of the Iranian scientist comes as part of Israel's attempts to disrupt Iran's nuclear energy program, which Tel Aviv accuses of having military dimensions. Iran has time and again dismissed such allegations and signed the 2015 nuclear deal with the world powers as a sign of goodwill.
Fakhrizadeh now becomes the fifth Iranian nuclear scientist who was eliminated in a terror attack. While all indications attest to an Israeli involvement, Iranians here demand that the government take a harsh revenge. This, they say, would reduce the chances of more Iranian scientists becoming an easy target for terrorists. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Former Virginia State Senator Richard Black believes the assassination of Mohsen Fakhrizadeh is a coordinated action aimed at creating tension in the region and beyond.
It certainly points to a coordinated action to murder the scientist. Apparently, it's not the first time. It's been attempted many times before, and there have been Iranian nuclear scientists assassinated over the years repeatedly. These are acts of terrorism. There's nothing lawful about them. And they're often designed and timed to create as much tension as possible. In this case, there's at least some speculation that if Joe Biden is sworn in as president, that he might try to resurrect the JCPOA, the Iranian nuclear deal. That was disbanded several years ago, and it is possible that this was timed to create additional obstacles to any attempt by the Biden administration, if there is one, to try to make peace with Iran.
The highest court of the U.S. state of Pennsylvania has dismissed another lawsuit aimed at overturning the November the 3rd presidential election results in that state. The court unanimously rejected the suit filed by Republican supporters of President Donald Trump. The lawsuit claimed Pennsylvania's decision to allow absentee voting on demand was illegal. Justices noted the suit was filed months after the expiration of a time limit allowing the challenges to the state's mail-in voting law. Meanwhile, Trump promised to challenge the Wisconsin vote or vote count after a recount there. Trump said, quote, "We have found many illegal votes." He has been contesting the results of the election, whose results suggest his Democratic rival, Mr. Biden, is actually the winner. To the ever-grim news of the coronavirus, the number of its infections in the U.S. has surpassed the grim milestone of 13 million. More than 266,000 people have also died of the disease there. This is while a record number of over 91,000 people were hospitalized in a single day on Saturday. The U.S., mind you, is the worst country in the world in terms of infections and being hit. In the Americas, Brazil is right now the second hardest hit nation. It has reported a daily caseload of nearly 52,000 infections and nearly 600 deaths. Latin American nation has so far reported nearly 6.3 million cases and over 172,000 fatalities. Well, the pandemic surges across Europe as well, with countries reporting more cases and deaths. Italy reported over 26,000 infections and nearly 700 deaths. The country, which is the second worst hit nation in the continent after Britain, has so far posted over 1.5 million cases and more than 54,000 fatalities. In the UK, the number of infections rose by nearly 16,000, while the deaths increased by nearly 500. Turkey also registered over 30,000 cases and a record number of 182 fatalities. In Greece, the number of daily infections rose by more than 1,700, while the deaths rose by a record number of 121. Speaking of the second half in the UK, where police have clashed with protesters rallying against the government's coronavirus restrictions in London. Take a look. Police said they arrested scores of people as they tried to break up anti-lockdown and anti-vaccine protests. Police said the arrests were made for different offenses, including assaulting a police officer, possession of drugs, and breaching coronavirus restrictions. Earlier, police lined up in a number of streets in London's West End shopping district and confronted crowds of protesters in St. James's Park near Westminster. The anti-lockdown demonstrators were joined by groups who oppose a COVID-19 vaccine. In France, people have taken to the streets against a new law that would restrict sharing images of police. This comes only days after the country was shaken by footage showing officers beating and racially abusing a black man. Our correspondent in the French capital of Paris has filed a report.
A human tide, rarely seen, flooded in the streets of Paris and all over France in a freedom march against a new security law. The massive protest is held against President Macron's government that is pushing a new bill that restricts the ability to film police. Human rights associations and media are unanimous. This law would allow police brutality to go undiscovered and unpunished.
There's a huge popular opposition against this law. Even the Human Rights Commission of the United Nations and other international bodies criticize it. A social majority in this country refuses the implementation of this law. Since a long time, we alert the government on police brutality and violence against women. Violence against women during the lockdown is exploding, and the government remains inactive and guilty.
Two major events this week plead in favor of the protesters and of the importance of video footage to denounce police violence. First, French police dismantled a migrant camp in central Paris. The French government ordered an internal police investigation after police officers were filmed tossing migrants out of tents and intentionally tripping one while evacuating a protest camp.
It is important to film this kind of situations because it's part of freedom of expression. Filming with our phones is almost the only way of publishing this kind of violence against migrants, people from the suburb, against everybody.
And then a second video showed the violent arrest of a black music producer in Paris. Three police officers repeatedly punched and hit him during 20 minutes. The man told that the officers made racist insults.
Thanks to the images showing the beating by a kind of private militia attacking a music producer, the truth has come out. Without this video footage from a surveillance camera, the man would be in prison, accused for using violence against the police. That shows the importance of having a counter power in this country.
Under a huge pressure, Interior Minister Darmanin announced disciplinary proceedings as soon as possible, but that might be too little, too late. In the meantime, the protest is going on. A large majority in the French parliament voted in favor of the security law, but the Senate still has to approve it. Right-wing senators, a majority in the Senate, declared they will rewrite the law because it is unconstitutional. Chris Denhant, Paris.
Religious leaders call for greater efforts by EU authorities to tackle growing levels of Islamophobia and anti-Semitism across the 27-nation bloc. During a video conference organized by the European Commission, they also criticized the EU's treatment of refugees. Jerome Hughes is in Brussels.
Despite the apparent demise of the Trump era, it is clear that the far-right movement in the West is still alive and well. White supremacy, racism and xenophobia are problems in every EU country.
But this is the end! It's the end! Enough's enough!
Coordinated by the European Commission Brussels, religious leaders from all of the main faiths have just taken part in a video conference.
Reports of anti-Semitic and anti-Muslim attacks are now almost part of everyday life in our beloved Europe.
The leaders say the answer is to show more unity and greater mutual respect.
I want to say that if somebody hurts a Muslim sister, a Jewish brother, they are hurting me.
The European Union's much-criticized asylum policy also came under the spotlight during the event.
Europe loses its soul if we continue to watch people drowning in the Mediterranean. That is why we support civil rescue missions.
Religious leaders insist the European Union must do more to ensure refugees play a positive and productive role in society. Experts agree.
There were mistakes in integration of the migrants, and there were mistakes in education, or lack of education, or lack of access to the educational system.
In the past, Saudi Arabia has been criticized for sponsoring terrorism in the EU. The European Commission says it is easier to brainwash vulnerable young men when they do not feel part of a community.
This sense of belonging would be the best shield against radicalization, terrorism, and hatred.
Work is continuing to try and curtail terrorist recruitment online in the EU. However, sociologists believe that is not the root cause of the security issue.
They say the source of the problem is not the internet, but the current climate within society. The focus should be on changing that, they argue. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Now, Indian-ruled Kashmir heads to the polls for local elections amid beefed-up security. The first electoral process comes after New Delhi stripped the region of its autonomous status last year. Our correspondent in that part of the world, Shahanabad, reports.
After the abrogation of Kashmir's special status in August 2019, all electoral processes in the region were suspended and Kashmir came under the direct control of New Delhi. Also, the role of major pro-India political parties in Kashmir was belittled after New Delhi detained all pro-India politicians. The absence of people's political participation created a void in Kashmir's political sphere and raised many questions on New Delhi's claims of normalcy in the region. And to break the ice, amid tough security measures, New Delhi is holding local elections in 8 phases ending on December 19th. Large number of voters has braved cold weather to vote, and each of them has their own reasons.
Our educated youth are doing menial jobs. We have problems like improper roads and lack of electricity. Who will take up our issues to higher-ups? That's why we voted for our trusted candidate.
Election boycott calls in passed by the pro-independence camp of Kashmir were highly supported by the people of Kashmir. But this time they say they want to fight for equality and justice via elections.
We are seeking respect since we are treated as second-class citizens. The country's progress hardly reaches us. By casting our vote, we tell the champions of democracy to do justice. Earlier, our election boycott was an excuse for them. Now we will give them no excuse. We want equal rights and treatment.
While voters have their own reasons to cast ballots, candidates have their aims too.
I can't promise my people jobs and land rights because with Article 370 everything is gone. My goal is to safeguard my people against the plots of people with anti-Muslim agendas. I believe in peace and tranquility and I want to work for secularism in my block.
The main contesting parties in this local election are Bharatiya Janata Party, Indian National Congress and Alliance of Local Political Parties.
Amid heightened security, the elections in Indian-administered Kashmir are being portrayed by many as a step towards normalcy and peace in the region. However, experts say such electoral processes have hardly helped Kashmir in the past, adding long-lasting peace is only possible when the issue gets permanently resolved between India and Pakistan. Shahana Bhatt, Indian-administered Kashmir.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hoped for nothing but bounty, and from whom I feared nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence, I seek refuge in thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For thou art Allah, the best guardian, and thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to thee, addressing myself to thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to you for the hope of your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of thy creation, the summoner to thy truth. Exalt me with thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with thy eye, which never sleeps. And seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely, thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
The limelight.
Having lost the election as well as dozens of post-election challenges, Donald Trump's ongoing refusal to admit defeat is still doing damage to Joe Biden's transition to power. The formal process has finally begun, but it is weeks late and spent a long time starved of funds as Republican officials stonewalled usual procedures. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Richard Wolff. The piece is titled, How Trump is Destroying the Presidential Transition Process. Stay with us for more of Richard Wolff's article. Having lost the election as well as dozens of post-election challenges, Donald Trump's ongoing refusal to admit defeat is still doing damage to Joe Biden's transition to power. The formal process has finally begun, but it is weeks late and spent a long time starved of funds as Republican officials stonewalled usual procedures. But beyond the inconvenience and cost of a deferred start to his administration, what does the president-elect lose from the president's refusal to acknowledge the inevitable? The answer goes far beyond Donald Trump's hurt feelings or the desire among Biden supporters for some form of concession. Even the smoothest of transitions can be painfully slow for the world's largest economy. Presidential transitions are, at the best of times, impossibly unwieldy and inefficient. The federal government has more than 2 million full-time civil servants, but in fact employs another 9 million active-duty military, postal workers, contractors, and grantees. The workforce of more than 11 million is about to lose as many as 800 executives, among the more than 4,100 presidential appointments that need to be filled as soon as possible. In 2008, the incoming Obama administration enjoyed the full cooperation of the outgoing Bush presidency, as well as control of both sides of Congress. It took Barack Obama 1 month to fill half of the 60 priority positions that require Senate confirmation. But it took another year to fill the other half of the posts. The pace is already unimaginable given Donald Trump's obstruction of the transition and a promise by some Republican senators to block Joe Biden's nominees. Since the Bush-Obama handover, Congress has passed two laws to improve the 1963 law that governs presidential transitions, in each case to start the massive switch in management earlier than the election. The most recent update in 2015, led by Ted Kaufman, Joe Biden's former chief of staff who now runs the Biden transition, pushed the start of the handover to 6 months before the election. In practice, campaigns are reluctant to begin the detailed work of planning for power because they fear that it will look like they are arrogantly assuming victory and taking the voters for granted. Max Steyer, president and chief executive officer of Partnership for Public Service, a nonpartisan government reform group, says Donald Trump has exposed new flaws in an already flawed system. This is a massive undertaking in an ordinary time. It is an extraordinarily hard task, and this makes it much harder, Steyer says. What's been exposed here is a real problem and a challenge of the existing system. I think a lot of people have been appalled that cooperation isn't occurring, and I do think that there needs to be a specific legislative fix to ensure that the ascertainment decision is made with much more dispatch. Delays in transitions can lead to serious national security challenges. The 9/11 Commission found that the delayed transition followed the extended recount of the 2000 election prevented the incoming Bush administration from being fully prepared for the threat to the American security. The risks are those right in front of our faces, the need to respond to the pandemic and the economic crisis and racial equality issues, says Max Steyer. And then, there's what Rumsfeld called the known unknowns. We live in an uncertain world, and there are curveballs thrown at the country. We need to have a government that is ready for that as soon as they are in charge. In the last Democratic transition, speed was critical. Melody Barnes was part of the Obama transition in 2008, before leading the White House Domestic Policy Council. We probably had people going into departments and agencies within 2 or 3 days of the election, Melody Barnes says. As I remember it, there was election day, and the very next day, by noon, I had to be in meetings that would allow for the kickoff process that would allow teams to go in. When you walk in the door, you have to hit the ground running. In the early days, agency review teams seek critical information about policy, personnel, litigation and new regulations. That intelligence is relayed back to transition headquarters and may influence the new appointments under consideration. When you walk in the door and you are the Biden administration versus the Trump administration, you're still also the government of the United States, says Barnes. And the government is in court a lot, in a lot of different places, and there's regulation that was started in September, October, November, and it's moving through the process that continues in January and February. You've got to know what's going on and where it stands. For the Obama team, that included seeking the advice of career officials at the White House Office of Management and Budget to help shape the urgent need for stimulus spending after the financial crisis of 2008. Today, the Biden team That advice would focus on both stimulus spending and vaccine distribution. However, even when the transition begins in full, the early Republican roadblock suggests a long and fraught path to confirmation for Joe Biden's nominees. You have Lindsey Graham saying that Georgia election wasn't legitimate and ballots needed to be thrown out, says Melanie Barnes. He's also holding the hearings in the Senate, potentially managing the confirmation hearing for the Attorney General. Janet Napolitano talks about Inauguration Day in 2008 and sitting in the view stand with the other nominees. They were getting tapped on the shoulder as they were getting confirmed by the Senate. You know, there won't be a lot of shoulder tapping happening this time. That points to the far bigger problem with American political appointments, the spoil system that last underwent reform in 1883 after James Garfield was assassinated by a disgruntled and deranged supporter who believed he was owed a high-profile job. The alternative, a larger civil service, would lead to less political patronage and more policy professionalism. But at a time when Trump supporters claim they are opposed to something called the deep state, it may be hard to win broad backing for reforms. My hope is that you see more senior career leaders like Tony Fauci responsible for things and fewer political appointees who are chosen on the basis of their political affiliation, says Max Steyer. There's a big distance between where the US stands and pretty much any other democracy. The spoil system in the US isn't represented at the scale it is in Britain or any other major democracy.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the Internet. Our Internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
first suspended, now reinstated, but without the whip. Jeremy Corbyn has been at the center of an anti-Semitism smear campaign that has plagued the Labour Party. How did this begin and what led to the suspension of the former Labour leader? I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. The Equalities and Human Rights Commission is the UK's watchdog on racism. After years of allegations that the Labour Party was becoming a hotbed of anti-Semitism under Jeremy Corbyn, in May 2019, the EHRC launched an inquiry. Last month, it published its findings in a report. In the report, the EHRC accuses Labour leadership of political interference in anti-Semitism complaints, failure to provide adequate training to those handling anti-Semitism complaints, and harassment of those who complained. In a report that is 130 pages long, the EHRC found two cases of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. Now, granted, that's two cases too many. Anti-Semitism is wrong, racism is wrong. Nonetheless, this doesn't match the description that we've been hearing from the British media and political establishment for the last couple of years, that Jeremy Corbyn is an anti-Semite, or that he fostered a culture of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party, and that this was widespread. Those are two completely different things. And when Jeremy Corbyn pointed this out, the day of the report's release, he was suspended.
The numbers have been exaggerated, in my view. The public perception in an opinion poll last year was that one third of all Labour Party members were somehow or other under suspicion of anti-Semitism. The reality is it was 0.3% of party members had a case against them which had to be put through the process. And so I think it's clear that we do not accept, I do not accept, Keir Starmer does not accept, none of us accept anti-Semitism in any form whatsoever in our party.
To talk more, I'm joined by Israeli-American author and activist Miko Pelid. Hi, Miko. Thanks for coming on. It's good to have you.
Sure. It's a pleasure to be with you. Thank you.
Miko, can I just get your initial thoughts and reaction on Jeremy Corbyn being suspended and his statement that the problem of anti-Semitism was dramatically overstated for political reasons? Do you agree with that assessment? Do you think that's an accurate statement?
Well, I think the accusations of anti-Semitism were all completely and utterly false. They had nothing to do. The attacks against him, which I believe has been in place for at least till since 2016, and against all of the people that supported him in the party, in other words, his entire support network, had nothing to do with anti-Semitism or racism. He and all of his supporters do not have a racist bone or an anti-Semitic cell in their bodies. This was a politically motivated witch hunt against anybody who might stand up for the rights of Palestinians, anyone who has progressive views on the issue, anyone who dares to criticize Israel or threaten Israel in any way, shape, or form. And the idea that an activist like him, a man of conscience like him, would occupy Downing Street 10 was, you know, the Zionists' worst nightmare, and they were not going to allow it to happen.
If we look at the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance, their working definition of anti-Semitism formed the backbone of the EHRC, and this definition was also adopted by the Labour Party in 2018. Now, underneath the definition, there's a few examples of what they consider to be anti-Semitism. I quote here, denying the Jewish people their right to self-determination, for example, claiming the existence of the State of Israel is a racist endeavor. Miko, you were born in Israel, you come from a very important Israeli family, you're Jewish, and you're a very staunch critic of Zionism, of Israel, and you've also said that Zionism is racism. So, I mean, does that mean you're anti-Semitic now, according to their definition?
Yes, absolutely. But I think it's important to clarify, Zionism is not an expression of Jewish self-determination. Zionism is an expression of Zionist self-determination and the self-determination of Israelis, not of Jews. And so what they've done is they framed it in a way that to defend themselves and also to gag anybody who would even think to criticize Israel with this definition. So now if you tell the truth, which is that the State of Israel has no legitimacy and is founded on a racist ideology, you're automatically anti-Semitic. But both of these claims are true whether they call you anti-Semitic or not. But yes, definitely, according to their definition, I am, and many of my people I respect, and certainly Jeremy Corbyn and others, and all the Palestinians, by the way, every single Palestinian is also anti-Semitic.
So, Miko, we know that the neoliberals in the party, the Blairites, have tried very hard to get rid of Jeremy Corbyn. However, how extensive would you describe the role of the Zionist lobby in getting Jeremy Corbyn suspended? Because, you know, a lot of people know what AIPAC is in the U.S., for example, but I don't think they really understand that Israel also plays a political role in the United Kingdom.
Well, there are AIPAC equivalents in every single country in Europe. And obviously, Britain is a very, very crucially important country. And so there are the same kind of Zionist agents working there as there are in the United States. You have what they call the Board of Deputies of British Jews. You've got different Zionist groups within the different parties, the Labour Party and excuse me, and so on. So they work and they actually work very closely with the Israeli embassy. In order, right. And there's no question that as soon as it was clear that Jeremy Corbyn was going to lead the Labour Party, they were going to do everything they possibly could to make sure he would not enter Downing Street 10. And the New Liberals, the Blairites, of course, were great allies, and they were happy to work together. There's no question about that.
Ayelet Namias Verben, she's a member of the Knesset, the Israeli Parliament, and just after Corbyn was suspended, there's a video of her boasting, essentially, that she played a role. She was a piece of the puzzle, as she says, in getting him suspended. What's your reaction to that video? What did you make of that?
It's not surprising because this is well known. I mean, Israel did everything they possibly can, and they're proud of their so-called accomplishment. They see this as an accomplishment. The bringing down of a man who his entire life, who dedicated his entire life to fight racism and fight injustice, is what they take pride in, because the state of Israel represents racism and injustice. And so what is absurd here, that people who represent the state of Israel or different aspects within the Israeli political spectrum who are racists, who are engaged in a racist, in operating and maintaining a racist state, who are engaged in what can only be described as genocide, ethnic cleansing, and apartheid, are accusing Jeremy Corbyn, who spent his whole life fighting these things, as racist and anti-Semitic. And what is very, very, very worrisome is that they succeeded. They succeeded in a very big way, and the rest of the world is watching this and just nodding instead of standing up and saying, "Are you out of your minds? This is absurd."
Miko, how do you feel that this political witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn fits into the larger scheme of actually fighting anti-Semitism globally?
Well, look, anti-Semitism is a form of racism. I mean, if somebody's an anti-Semitic, they're probably racist against everybody else too. Racism is racism. And so I think what's important is to fight racism and to promote tolerance everywhere, which of course this is why Israel is not, as they, some people claim, the response to the Holocaust. Number one, most Jewish people who survived the Holocaust did not go to Israel. And number two, another racist regime is never a response to a racist regime somewhere else. What we need is more tolerance. What we need is to fight racism. What we feel is to fight bigotry and to resist violence and so forth. So, you know, fighting racism is important everywhere. It's a problem everywhere. Racism, anti-Semitism, all forms of racism are problematic, and they all need to be fought with the same vigor, with the same kind of passion that Jeremy Corbyn actually displayed his entire life, and the people around him that were also brought down displayed their entire life. So if people really care about anti-Semitism, Jeremy Corbyn is their man.
Thanks very much for coming on, Miko. Appreciate your time.
Anytime. Thank you.
Jeremy Corbyn has made it extremely clear on many occasions that he opposes anti-Semitism and that it has no place in the Labour Party. Jeremy Corbyn is someone who's fought against racism his entire life. He's known for that, both in the UK and outside, internationally. This is a guy who has fought against racism in all forms, against anti-Semitism. He's championed the rights of workers. He's an anti-imperialist. He's an anti-war voice, an advocate for peace. despite this, despite Jeremy Corbyn's unimpeachable record, the British media, the British political establishment and the Zionist lobby have spent the last couple of years attacking him relentlessly and trying to smear him as either an anti-Semite himself or someone who enabled a culture of anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. I mean, I myself have criticized his handling of the issue, but to call the man a racist or that he is someone who enables racism is utterly absurd and ridiculous. What this all comes down to is the neoliberal establishment, the British media, the Zionists will be trying to get rid of pro-Palestinian voices, trying to get rid of and purge the actual left within the Labour Party. Anti-Semitism is a serious issue, and it should be opposed by the Labour Party. Fighting against racism is a fundamentally leftist value. And that's why we shouldn't confuse anti-Semitism with anti-Zionism, which is unfortunately what the media, what Keir Starmer, the now Labour leader, is doing. Keir Starmer himself has said that he is a Zionist without qualification. This man is a clear supporter of the Israeli apartheid state, and the last couple of years, we've seen not just Corbyn, but other voices championing the rights of Palestinians being purged, being kicked out of the party, being reprimanded, being suspended. There's a clear drive here to get rid of people who stand up to the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians by the Israeli occupation. Chris Williamson, who's also a former Labour MP and a close friend of Jeremy Corbyn, was also unfairly suspended from the Labour Party. Chris is a staunch anti-imperialist, he's a real leftist, and he's fought against racism his entire life as well. I'm joined by him now. Hi, Chris. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it. It's a real honor. Thank you. I mean, I'm a big admirer of your work.
I really appreciate it. Thank you. Chris, can I just get your initial thoughts on the EHRC report and Jeremy being suspended?
Well, I mean, the EHRC is a disgraced organisation. It's a partisan organisation. It's been accused of institutional racism. It doesn't have any black or Muslim commissioners on its board. And indeed, two of the black and Muslim commissioners that it did have on the board were removed because they were deemed to be too loud and vocal about issues of race. They're very close to the Conservative Party, had a strong relationship as well with the New Labour former New Labour government, New Labour regime, and they've come forward with a partisan report. I mean, I think the conclusions were written before the report had actually really, you know, seen the light of day, frankly. At the end of the day, they were trying to make the assertion that the Labour Party had a massive problem with anti-Semitism, that it was institutionally anti-Semitic. They didn't make that finding about institutional anti-Semitism, but they did actually argue that Labour was guilty of unlawful conduct and harassing the Jewish community based on two cases, two questionable cases, it's got to be said. They had six people initially in the initial report, six. And as a result of the legal representations that I made, they removed my name and three others. And they were left then with two people. And the way the corporate media has covered this as if this is some terrible, shaming revelation about institutional anti-Semitism inside the Labour Party, when it's anything but. I mean, even if you accept at face value, two people out of a membership of 500,000 hardly constitutes a major problem for the Labour Party.
I wanted to ask you more about how you litigated and got your name removed from the report. Can you tell us more about that?
Basically, we threatened them that if they didn't remove my name, that I would take further legal action against them in the High Court to restrain them from publishing the report, and wouldn't be satisfied with anything short of my complete removal from the report, because I was anything but what they were accusing me of doing. I've spent my life fighting racism going back to the 1970s, actually putting my personal safety at risk, confronting fascists on the street in the 1970s, and indeed on building sites when I was a young apprentice bricklayer, when casual racism was quite a thing in the 1970s in the UK. And I would regularly challenge the casual racism that I heard at that time on building sites, and, you know, nearly got beaten up on more than a few occasions. So, you know, I'm not going to take any lectures from people who are bad faith actors and attempting to try and, you know, smear somebody, you know, with my record. And indeed, somebody with Jeremy Corbyn's record, which is an unimpeachable anti-racist record, and yet he's being demonised in the way in which he speaks. Absolutely outrageous.
It really cannot be overstated how much the British media hate Jeremy Corbyn and have relentlessly attacked and smeared him during the last couple of years. I mean, to begin with, the vast majority of printed media in the United Kingdom is right-wing, okay? But even liberal left publications like The Guardian led the charge against Corbyn and smeared him relentlessly, and still are. Not even Ed Miliband or Gordon Brown or Tony Blair, the war criminal who destroyed Iraq, who has the blood of a million Iraqis on his hands, was smeared to this level by any of the mainstream media in the UK. Think of that. Think about how Bernie Sanders is smeared in the United States, except 100 times worse. Okay? Jeremy Corbyn has been called anything you can imagine. He's been called a jihadist sympathizer. He's been called a terrorist. He's been accused of wanting to abolish the monarchy and the army. He's been accused of a million things under the sun. So the mainstream media were not just complicit, they were more than happy to participate in this targeted smear campaign against leftists in the Labour Party, and specifically Jeremy Corbyn. It's not just conjecture, it's not just speculation or me saying that. This is actually backed up by raw data. A report by The Independent found that 75% of media coverage of Jeremy Corbyn was negative and factually misrepresented him. That is astonishing. For anyone to objectively say that Jeremy Corbyn has not been the target of a smear campaign by the Zionist lobby, by the political establishment in the UK, by the British media themselves, is utterly delusional and dishonest. But frankly speaking, these attacks don't just come from the Zionist lobby or from the British media. They also come from within the Labour Party itself. Even though Jeremy Corbyn won the leadership contest in 2015 by attracting a lot of new members to the Labour Party, a lot of youth with his anti-war message, with his populist message, this didn't change the fact that a lot of his colleagues in the parliamentary Labour Party are liberals, are Blairites, are to the right of him. They even tried to oust him in a coup, in a vote of no confidence in 2016. This vicious smear campaign by all of these actors is what contributed eventually to Labour's catastrophic loss a year ago in the 2019 elections. However, this witch hunt against Jeremy Corbyn, against the left wing of the Labour Party, didn't stop after the loss of the election. When Keir Starmer took over, who again is a Zionist without qualification, as he says, and a former prosecutor and former British intelligence, when he took over, he continued to persecute the left wing of the Labour Party. He appointed a bunch of Blairites to his cabinet, and he interfered in what was supposed to be an impartial investigation. Starmer suspended Jeremy Corbyn not even 24 hours after his comments about the EHRC report. Again, Corbyn acknowledged there was a problem with anti-Semitism. He just said that it was blown up by the media, which is factually true. Keir Starmer suspended him, and last week when the National Executive Committee reinstated Jeremy Corbyn as a Labour member, Keir Starmer withheld the whip, meaning that Jeremy Corbyn is now standing in Parliament as an independent. So even though he's back in the Labour Party, he is not back in the parliamentary Labour Party. Chris, you were suspended from the Labour Party in 2019, very unfairly, I might add, and now Jeremy Corbyn as well. Do you feel there's been a targeted campaign against pro-Palestinian voices or anti-Zionist voices within Labour?
Most definitely. I mean, the Israel lobby is all over this. I mean, the two complainants to the Equalities and Human Rights Commission are out-and-out Zionist organisations, the so-called Campaign Against Anti-Semitism and the self-styled Jewish Labour Movement, are both out-and-out Zionist organisations, and there is no doubt that that was the agenda to take out prominent pro-Palestinian voices. It was unconscionable to them to have someone like Jeremy Corbyn, who was an anti-imperialist, somebody who was very supportive and sympathetic to the cause of the Palestinians, somebody who had set his stall out to implement an ethical foreign policy were Labour to get into office, and indeed had appointed a shadow minister for peace and disarmament. They took out Ken Livingstone, who was a prominent anti-racist, probably somebody who's done more for the cause of anti-racism than anybody, actually, any politician in Britain when he was leader of the Greater London Council and then the London Mayor. Absolute, solid anti-racist. He was one of the first high-profile casualties. And then people like Mark Wadsworth, a well-known black anti-racist who introduced Nelson Mandela to the Stephen Lawrence family and was very instrumental in you know, supporting the Lawrence family in getting some semblance of justice for their son. He was thrown under the bus. He was accused of being a bigot and anti-Semite. Somebody who's an out-and-out, you know, anti-racist. Jackie Walker, another vice chair of Momentum, a black Jewish prominent member of the party, an anti-racist trainer. She was also taken out. And because we had a unique moment in history where we could have had a socialist government in Britain that would have transformed the economic landscape in Britain for British right. citizens and tackled grotesque inequality, but also, more significantly, I think, in many ways, had an anti-imperialist foreign policy that would have been incredibly sympathetic to and supportive of the Palestinian people and would have really held the rogue Israeli state's feet to the fire in relation to the way in which they're flagrantly disregarding their international law obligations and so on. That was unconscionable. That was what this was all about.
Why do you think they're going to such lengths if Corbyn's no longer the leader anyway, and we've got Keir Starmer, who's heading Labour now?
It's part of this maximalist strategy that they are absolutely keen to utterly crush any semblance of a kind of a progressive left inside the Labour Party, or the Labour Party being a potential vehicle for an ethical pro-Palestinian policy, and a socialist, sort of corporate capitalist party. And what they're determined to do is to create a safe opposition, if I can put it like that, a party in Britain, which is right. essentially the flip side of the current government. You know, we've got two establishment parties that are two sides of the same coin. In the same way that in the United States we have the Democrats and the Republicans, which in reality yeah. doesn't really matter who gets into government. You know, nothing much changes, and that's where we're at in Britain now, and that's why I think we absolutely, in my opinion, need to, in Britain, be working to build an alternative movement and ultimately an alternative electoral vehicle, because I think the Labour Party is utterly broken. And what I've been saying is that the best thing we can do is to kill it and start again.
Two sides of the same coin. Overseas operations bill going through, spy cops bill going through, no opposition whatsoever from Labour. I mean, it's pathetic, it's grotesque. What is the future of the Labour Party? Is there one at all?
Look, Labour as a vehicle for socialism, as a vehicle for progressive change, it's over, it's finished. You know, Tony Benn, the great Tony Benn, great socialist who best